when I came back to South Africa, I remember having a drink with you at the Bambini Trust Bar. I eventually persuaded you to come back and to start the company with me and the Johannesburg agency in October 2010.
Australia gave me that perspective, and I know everything works and it's beautiful. And you know, when you live in South Africa, one's got to look at it from the point of view of being vested, not being an investor. Because if you're vested, you know, you don't just have commercial interest in this market. You're vested because you live here and it's your home. It's been a long time since I've seen Switzerland won significant creative awards. You know, someone said to me, you know, the last thing the Swiss invented was the cuckoo clock. And maybe it's because there is no crisis in that country.
Hi, I'm Mike Abel, a business, marketing and communications specialist and the founder of MNC Saatchi Abel. I'm a family man, a problem solver, a futurist, and an optimist at heart. Welcome to my podcast, Willing and Able, the home of hopeful conversations that challenge perspectives. It's a continuation of the ideas and conversations I began in my book, Willing and Able, Lessons from a Decade in Crisis. My guest today is Jacques Berger, who has more than 20 years' experience in leading communications agencies in Southern Africa and Australia, including Ogilvy, the Campaign Palace Australia, part of WPP, and the MNC Saatchi Group, South Africa. He was one of the top 40 under 40s in 2009 and is a popular guest speaker and thought leader, and has led the communication strategies and brand building work for the likes of the Heineken Group, Volkswagen South Africa, Standard Bank, and Lexus, Castle Lager, to name just a few. He also co-founded MNC Saatchi Abel with me in 2010, where he is now the group CEO, and is also my long-time partner in crime and a great friend. Welcome, Jacques. So great to have you here today.
Thank you, Mike. Good to be here.
I was wondering, how long exactly have we known each other now?
Oh my gosh, I got to work that out. I think I met you in 1998, yes.
Well, what is that, about 25 years?
25 years, yeah.
So do you still remember what your first impressions were of me the day we met?
Well, I suppose I always wanted to work for you. Well, not knowing you, but knowing that you headed up the VW account at the time and I was keen to work on VW.
So not so much me?
No, not so much you. Okay. And then starting out at Ogilvy, I actually didn't work for you. I started off working on the Old Mutual account. So my initial impressions were distant, but I suppose if I had to cast my mind back to that time, I would say young. I had hair. I remember you being, I just thought, gosh, this guy's incredibly young. How can he be a business director
and
on the board?
Yes.
Of the company. So I suppose I was struck by some impressive credentials. And I think what was interesting is, as my time progressed at Ogilvy, I obviously got to know you a little bit more. And then I suppose my ambition to work on the VW account became, got an extra layer to it, in that I didn't just want to work on Volkswagen, but actually also wanted to work with you. You know, once I got to know you better and got a sense of how you lead and how you were leading your team and the way people were talking about you, I found inspiring. And I was like, I've got to make a plan to get closer to this man. I had a sense that, connecting my trailer to your car might take me places.
Well, that's very generous of you, especially considering that this chat is about you and not me. But I did ask that first question to lead you into a bit of, fabulousness,
yes,
and all of that. But back to
it's
you.
It's always nicer when other people say it about you than when you have to say it about yourself.
I called my book Lessons from a Decade in Crisis, Shark, and you titled a piece in the Daily Maverick, "This is a once-in-a-century crisis. Let's not waste it." I don't know if you recall that.
I do.
But what do you think it is about this crisis that we're in right now that creates opportunities?
Yeah, I think that is it. Wasn't that good at science at school, but I think there is something where they talk about, you know, energy or a reaction in the one way, one direction results in an opposite and equal energy or sense of movement in the other direction.
Isaac Newton.
Is that the one? Mm. Good. You see, probably got higher marks than I did at school.
Every force and action has an equal but opposite force and reaction.
There you go. And so I think what's interesting about the crisis that we're in right now, and I suppose the pressure that we face in this country on on many levels and in many ways, is I think that it creates an opportunity for that opposite force to take place. And I think that, you know, South Africa has a very, very long history of, you know, us seemingly loving the idea of pushing ourselves to the very precipice, kind of, you know, dangling off the cliff and then pulling ourselves back. I don't know why we do that. And why we feel like we have to get to such a scary place before we feel propelled to start fixing things. But I do think that what I'm seeing right now in this crisis is how people are taking that force and shifting it in the opposite direction and in a positive direction. And I think that's exciting. So I do think that, you know, out of crisis, out of challenge comes opportunity. You know, there's always that open space that gets created through crisis. I think that that pressure often brings out a force and a belief in individuals to act and to change and to will, because it becomes a matter of survival almost. It's not pleasant in the moment, and I think it can be very scary, and it takes a lot of effort and it takes a lot of energy. But I think if you're able to use that momentum, then I think it creates great opportunity. I think if you look at it from the perspective of our industry, you know, if you look at creative recognition at Cannes, for instance, let's look at the countries that show up year after year and do very well, punch well above their weight. You know, often it's countries, not just like South Africa, but like Brazil, you know, that have a lot of challenges in market. It's been a long time since I've seen Switzerland won significant creative awards. You know, someone said to me, you know, the last thing the Swiss invented was the cuckoo clock. And maybe it's because there is no crisis in that country. There are no challenges. You know, there's nothing that pushes you to think different, to find the alternative. So I think that, you know, out of crisis often comes innovation and new ideas and different ways, because you're forced to think very differently, which I think is exciting.
I think it is. I mean, while you're talking, it reminds me of that saying, necessity is the mother of invention, you know, and as we all know, nature has its own way. Enough pressure on coal creates a diamond. And I think those types of situations do force people to become resourceful, innovative, and resilient, which is ultimately, I guess, what you need to succeed, which I think leads me, funnily enough, to the TED Talk I gave last year, where I said, I love problems, because without problems, there is no opportunity, and with no opportunity, there is no innovation. What is it that you respond particularly well to in a crisis? Because I know you are, I mean, I think of you a bit like a fireman. You know, where there's a fire, you don't leave the building, you grab an extinguisher and you run up. What is it that makes you so attracted, I guess, to problem solving?
It's an interesting question. I think that, you know, there are two kinds of people, I believe, in the world. You know, there are people who fight and there are people who flight when it comes to a crisis. And so either you run as fast as you can in the opposite direction or you stay. I'm not quite sure what makes you stay. I don't know if I figured that one out. But I do think what excites me about a crisis or a problem is that I get a thrill out of fixing it and solving it and being able to step back and go, it's better as a result of what I've done versus just leaving something be. I don't subscribe to negative energy, and I don't subscribe to the idea of being a victim. And I suppose that's why I think often when you look at a crisis or you look at a challenge, it's one can go into victim mode and go, oh, well, what can I do? Or it's too late or it's too big. I kind of look at that as negative energy and a passive stance versus going, well, if I do something and I lean into it, who knows, I might just solve it. And I think what is exciting is when you start to orientate like that in how you behave in life and in work, then it becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because when you just give it a go, you find that sometimes it's not as hard as you think, and sometimes your ability to solve and to improve a situation or a project or just life in general is actually within reach if you just put your mind to it. And I think that builds that sense of confidence that you are able to do it. Not always, but often. And I think then, you know, the fear is replaced with excitement.
No, that's true. I mean, it's interesting because I often think that if I could see anything positive come out of negativity, then I might wallow in negativity. But I've never, ever seen anything good come out of that. So, you know.
100% right. I mean, someone was saying to me, in fact, my wife was saying to me the other day, she was having a moan. And I said, just move beyond this. And she said to me, I know that's your way. I know you've already moved on and you've already found the solution. But can you just come and sit here with me and be a bit sad for a moment? I was like, no, I can't. It's wasted energy. Come, let's move. Let's go for lunch. Solved. Fixed. Sorted.
Next time, sit with her and listen.
I know. I've got to work on that.
I've got about 7 years head start on you on the marriage thing. Yes. One can still learn a little bit there. You know, you and I, you spoke about fight or flight. You and I left the country actually at a very similar time in 2008 when we were both incredibly nervous, I guess, of the prospect of somebody who had, I don't know, 1,200 counts of fraud or whatever it might have been against him becoming our president at the time, being Jacob Zuma, president, obviously in inverted commas. And we both went to Australia. I went to go and run the MNC Saatchi group there. You went to go and run the Campaign Palace. And albeit that we were friends in Australia, we were also frenemies because we were both trying to build our companies. And when I came back to South Africa, I remember having a drink with you at the Bambini Trust Bar. And I ordered a particular
Street.
You remember that?
I do.
And I remember ordering a very expensive glass of New Zealand Pinot Noir for you to lull you back into coming back with me to South Africa. And I remember you clinking your glass against mine and saying, good luck with that, Mikey. I eventually persuaded you to come back and to start the company with me and the Johannesburg agency in October 2010. How different do you think South Africa is today in 2023 to when you got back in September 2010?
Or maybe I should start with how I thought the country was different from when I left for Australia to when I came back.
Yeah.
And I think that I always say to people, the one thing that living in Australia taught me was that it was perspective. Because I think that, you know, when you've lived in South Africa all your life, you have a view on certain things. But sometimes it takes, you know, kind of moving to another country and another culture and to confront that ideal, or I suppose the thought that the grass is always greener on the other side, and to go and, you know, kind of graze on the other side for a little bit and then come back to this paddock. And I would say Australia gave me that perspective, and I came back to South Africa with the realization that some of what I thought was wrong about this country and some of what I thought was missing about this country actually wasn't that bad. And that, you know, every market in the world has its own set of challenges and its own things that you like or don't like. So when I came back, I kind of looked at some of the parts of South Africa that I didn't like or that I wasn't comfortable with. And I thought, it's not so bad. And then there are other things that I looked at and I thought, it's even worse than I thought. You know, now that you've got the perspective of having lived elsewhere. And if I look at South Africa in 2010 versus South Africa now, I think the same largely applies. I think a lot of things have gotten a whole lot worse. I don't think there's any denying that. And I think that if you sit here in 2023 and you ask me, what is there to be optimistic about right now in the country? I would have to say very little. Very, very little. You know, we don't have power. We are in a, you know, a significant economic and political crisis. And you just got to pick up the paper every day, and you try and got to try and hunt for those stories, and you don't find them. So I suppose that is scary when you look at it on paper. But as I think you and I spoke the other day, you know, when you live in South Africa, one's got to look at it from the point of view of being vested, not being an investor. Because if you're vested, you know, you don't just have commercial interest in this market. You're vested because you live here and it's your home. And so it's not a transactional relationship that you can kind of weigh up the pros and cons on a piece of paper. And I think that what still amazes me about South Africa and why I've got hope for South Africa, and whilst I think that, you know, in many ways we are looking a whole lot worse on the balance sheet than we did in 2010, as we sit here in 2023, I think the fighting spirit and the geest of South Africans and people in South Africa are incredible. The resilience, you know, the the helpfulness, the kindness, you know, I see it every day, you know, just ordinary people going about their daily lives, trying to make a living, trying to, you know, create a world where the next generation will be better off than what we are. You see what private enterprise are doing in this country in terms of how they're helping to uplift. You know, I think there are brilliant human stories in this country, and that's what gives me hope. So whilst on the balance sheet we're looking pretty bankrupt right now, you've got to look at a broad collective of 60 odd million people and go, you know, well, if half of those people are good human beings and want to make this work, why can't we do that? And I think that there's great proof that we've faced many, many challenges before as a country. And because of that unique South African spirit and the can-do attitude and the resilience, we've managed to get through it. So I have to believe that we can do that again.
Well, I think we can. I mean, you once famously told Entrepreneur magazine that optimism has a deadline.
Yes.
And I think you've spoken a little bit about that now, because reading between the lines, when you say the best thing about our country is the people, all the people aren't changing. You know, they are, to your expression, vested. They're going to be here. But I also think, you know, news channels, we all know that 1 gram of loss weighs 10 times more than a gram of gain. And news channels specialize in negativity because they get more eyeballs and more clicks out of bad news and good news. Now, in no way am I negating the significant challenges that the country faces. But, you know, I met with these entrepreneurs the other day. One of them moved from Palo Alto to South Africa, and he believes that Cape Town, for example, is going to be the next great place in the world for tech development. So you'll have, you know, Silicon Valley, you'll have the Tel Aviv area, and then you'll have Cape Town from a lifestyle perspective. So I know that you mix and talk to a lot of entrepreneurs. Do you also believe that there's a lot happening in South Africa that doesn't get a lot of attention and that is actually building an economy, a new economy that we might not necessarily be aware of?
100%. I think that I'm fortunate to have a wide mix of friends, many of them living here, but not being South Africans. I've got friends who live here who are from South America, from the UK, from the US. And it's fascinating to hear their perspective and their positive view on South Africa. And I kind of go, why are you here? Why are you doing business here? Why do you live here? Why are you raising your families here? And they talk about opportunity, and they talk about, you know, all the positives that I think that we often take for granted. You know, people just talk about space. They talk about light, the light. They talk about the kindness of the people, the spirit of diversity, and how exciting that is in terms of innovation. So I think there's a lot of that bubbling. I always say, if you look at the statistics, if you just take unemployment as a statistic, it can't be right. Because if that were true, then we would see a whole lot more homeless people on the streets. We'd see a whole lot more chaos, but you don't see that. So I think there's a massive informal economy that happens with people hustling every day to make money, to somehow get food on the table. And I think beyond that, I think that there's an exciting movement around people who are leaning heavily into the entrepreneurial space. And I don't think it's always recorded or documented or kind of even accurately reflected. So I think that, I think sometimes the statistics look worse than how the reality presents themselves. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying we don't have challenges, but I think that there's a lot of hope.
You know, it's a frustrating thing for me because, you know, that I am a bit of a vigilante for trying to create a shared economy and an inclusive culture in our country. And I look at the myriad of assets that we have, and I still think that there's time to do something miraculous. You know, if you look at where Dubai was or Singapore was, you know, 20 years ago, they were nowhere. And I really do believe that if the right people start making the right decisions now, 20 years from now, because of all of our natural assets, you know, be it minerals, be it agri, be it IT, be it financial services, mobile technology, there are very many brilliant people here, and a lot of the brilliant people are shaking up the world. And I think if they understood the optimism, and if more of them, you know, decided to become both invested and vested, I think they would able to make a significant difference. So for those of them that are hopefully listening to this podcast, I certainly think it's something to consider. I mean, I was at a dinner party the other night with some Swedes, and they were saying how much they love living in South Africa because they're not judged while they live here. And I heard you telling a story to someone the other day when you bumped into a Swedish person that was traveling with us at a conference. Do you want to just share that story? Because I think it's a lovely story for us to reflect on how lucky we are.
Yeah, so we were at a conference in Singapore. I think it was 3-4 years ago. Gosh, COVID's created a bit of a timeline gap in my mind. I think about 4 years ago. And there was a strategy partner from our office in Stockholm. And she told me that she was very embarrassed to tell her friends that she had flown to Singapore for this meeting because of the you know, her carbon footprint or the negative carbon footprint that she created with through flying to Singapore. To which I responded to her, I said to her, well, I was very embarrassed to tell my friends that I've only flown to Singapore this year.
Only you, Jacques.
Yeah, no, let me not get the fossil fuel crowd onto me. Yeah. But I think it does talk to judging, you know, and I think that we are very, very lucky to live in a country where there is such diversity and where diversity is celebrated. And I think that creates the freedom for people to express themselves, to be who they are, to say what they'd like to have that freedom. And I think it's very, very special. And that differences are celebrated versus being judged. Mostly.
I agree with you. And when you talk about diversity and the magic that comes from it, I mean, I'm always immensely proud when you see, you know, a man like Maxhosa Laduma, who comes from the Eastern Cape, you know, shaking up the fashion world with, you know, really beautiful ethnic traditional designs that go back, you know, hundreds of years. You look at how DJ Black Coffee is shaking up the world, or Nelson Makamo. There is a huge amount of magic and creativity that is coming out of our diversity. And I think that this is a very rich place to live in terms of experience. You know, I often talk about living in an experience economy, that people want to feel things and do things, they don't just want to watch things. Do you think this is changing our audiences today? I mean, you also, like me, being my partner in the marketing communications world, what do you think of the experience economy? Is it here to stay? Is it going to grow? Is it going to recede? What are your thoughts around that?
You know, I always say it's not what people say, but what people do. And I think that lived experiences is experiences is what make things tangible. You know, it creates the feeling, it manifests. It's not just messaging. So I think it is important, and I think it's powerful, and you can see why people are attracted to it. And I think particularly in the world of brand and marketing, I think largely as a result of the digital era in which we live, people are able to match the message to the experience. So I always used to say, you know, 20, 30 years ago, if you were a hotel, you could have a beautiful brochure that you could print and tell people about, you know, the amazing space that you've got, and that might lure you to go and visit that hotel. Now I go onto TripAdvisor and I read what 400 people have said and how 20 of them have complained about the bad room service. And it doesn't matter, you know, how beautiful the image of the room is that's in the brochure, I won't go to the hotel. And I think that starts to talk to how, you know, message is one thing, but experience is another. And I think those two are being brought together by the digital world where people can share those experiences and reflect on them in real time. And so as a brand and as a business, you can't hide behind a message. You've got to match it with what you do in terms of how you show up with your product, how you show up with your service, and therefore what the lived experience is. And I think that a key part today of building a brand is to understand, how does that manifest as an experience? What does it look like when people engage and interact with you live? And by the way, when I say brand, I include people in that, because humans are also brands. So, you know, it's one thing to listen to me or my point of view or have a conversation with me, but how do I behave? How do I show up? What's the experience that you have when you work with me, when you play with me? That ultimately becomes fundamental in terms of what people believe you are and who people believe you are. So I think experiences are here to stay. In fact, I think that Increasingly, people are calling bullshit on brands and on individuals who say some things that they don't do or that doesn't show up in behavior. And so I think that that's how people are going to continue to engage with brands.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting because of I guess it cuts to authenticity as well in terms of the brand experience. 100%. And when a brand tries to fake it. And it actually reminds me of a story you told me about your daughter and the experience economy and the Tiffany brand. So why don't you tell that story?
I've got two daughters and they, I suppose, living in a world where, or in a household where brands and marketing are often discussed. They've now, they lean heavily into brands, which is not always easy on the pocket. But my eldest has this obsession with the kind of classic Tiffany heart necklace. And she's been desperate to get one, and she's tried every angle. And we went on a holiday recently, and I thought, okay, we're going to treat her, and it was a special birthday, and I'm going to go buy her one. And we went into a Tiffany store, and she was very excited, and the lady showed her a gold one, which was eye-wateringly expensive. And I said, no, we just want the silver one, just the plain sterling silver one. And the sales assistant said to me, no, we don't sell those in store anymore. We'd only sell the gold ones, but you can get the sterling one online. Mm. You can buy it online. So we left the store and my daughter was very disappointed. And I said to her, but it's not a problem. I said, I'll order it online for you and we'll have it delivered to the hotel when we get to France. It'll be there. And she said to me, no, she doesn't want it anymore because what she wanted was for it to be wrapped in the store and put into a little blue box and, you know, into the, like that scene in Love Actually, I suppose, where Rowan Atkinson spends about 5 minutes, you know, wrapping a gift very extravagantly in store. She wanted that experience and she wanted to leave with the bag with the Tiffany's logo on it and, you know, I suppose take a selfie outside the store as the kids of today do. But it did make me think that, you know, her sense of that experience was so important.
Yeah.
What wrapped around that product, everything that the brand represents was something that she was wanting. And just to have the product unceremoniously, you know, kind of sent via DHL it wasn't the same thing. And so it actually, I suppose, detracted from her sense of the brand. And she said, no, not that interested. I want to buy it, you know. I want to buy it live. I want that experience. Yeah. And I think that it's now, you know, I believe that the LVMH group is on a journey to push Tiffany further upstream and trying to premiumize it. So, you know, it might well be part of that strategy to go, you know, we're not going to sell sterling silver in our stores anymore. And maybe it's worked for them. Who am I to argue with one of the richest men in the world that's made his money off luxury brands? But right or wrong, I think it's a good story when one reflects on the importance of experiences.
Yeah, look, I'm not sure that, and I could be proven wrong, that Tiffany is a super luxury brand. Mm. I think it's a masstige brand, or the upper end of masstige, really, which is a combination for those of you that aren't in advertising, an old term for the combination of mass and prestige, but. I think it's an accessible brand that people want to get into. So if they are going to sacrifice a volume strategy for a margin one, that'll be interesting to see. But as you say, who am I to question the great Bernard Arnault in his decision making? But what I am reminded about while you tell the story is two things, really. One is that when you are brand centric as a company, it's very easy to lose the customer. But when you're customer-centric, you'll always know how to intersect your brand perfectly into their lives. And I think they lost focus of that with your daughter. And she could also be a very valuable lifetime shopper. So when you get them in on the cheap silver, not that cheap, actually, as it happens, you know. Nothing's cheap on the Rand anymore.
Yes.
But the sterling silver is your entry into the brand. And if you're a lifetime customer, then one day you might migrate to something much more valuable. So I think it's quite short-term thinking on their part, potentially. And then the other thing,
unless they're not interested in her as a customer, which I think is also fine. Because, you know, sometimes I think where I see brands go wrong is that they try and be everything to everyone. And I quite like brands that
is
that
true.
Are focused and intentional in terms of their target and go, I always say it's easy to talk about who you are for.
Yep.
It's harder to talk about who you're not for. I always say, you know, brands, we often do this tone exercise. You know, we go like, what's the brand tone and what's the brand personality? And you see people put down all these words that are all positives that everybody would want to be. We're smart, we're modern, we're likable, we're charming. You know, I go, yes, like every other brand. Put down some negatives as who we are as a brand. We're arrogant. We're exclusive.
Yeah.
We don't have a heart. it's quite an interesting exercise. So, you know, maybe she's not the audience. That's also okay. But I agree with you around the power of being customer centric. I think it's so powerful in terms of, you know, if you don't understand your customer, how do you understand the message and how they're going to be receptive to it or not?
Yeah.
It's like often I hear people, you know, delivering public addresses and I go, so I can see you've spent a lot of time thinking about what you want to tell people and absolutely no time considering who your audience is and what they want to hear.
Yeah.
And, you know, you sit there and you feel completely disconnected and actually feel sorry for the speaker who's prepped all that work. And brands show up a little bit like that sometimes as well.
Well, I think that, you know, me being a bit old-fashioned when it comes to branding is I still like to subscribe to that view that the customer owns the brand or that the definition of a brand is how a customer feels about a product. And I think that's really important. And I think that you can try and stretch a brand and take a brand to places. But, you know, it's like playing tennis with somebody. If you don't have someone else on the other end of the net, you can hit as many balls over as you want, but eventually you're going to run out of balls. You need somebody to hit them back. And you'll need a willing customer, I guess, on the other side that's prepared to hit the ball back. And I guess in our commercial world, that means to buy the product and to speak well of it.
Mike Abel's book, Willing and Able, Lessons from a Decade in Crisis, captures the stories of clients and partners and the wins, losses, and learnings through his eyes in a career spanning 3 decades. Whether you're looking for courage or inspiration to learn what it takes to disrupt industries or discover how to transform your company meaningfully and truly empower your people, you'll find it between these pages. You can listen to the audiobook on Audible, download it on your Kindle, order it online, or find it at your favorite bookstore.
And while we're speaking about brands and experience and all of that, obviously the big buzzword since November last year when overnight we all heard about ChatGPT is AR, artificial intelligence.
As I call it, AI.
Huh?
AI.
I talk. Well, I think the funny thing about AI is that people don't really understand it. They think that it's ChatGPT at the moment or something like that, or OpenAI. Have you used it at all? And what do you see changing in the short to medium term as a result of AI being in our lives now, particularly in the creative industry?
Yeah, I did use it, Mike, because I had to, because I was asked to do a talk at Apple about AI as a supposed expert in AI. So I had to quickly go and see what it's all about.
You got AI to write your speech.
I got AI to write my speech. you know, I think that, as you said, firstly, it's not just about ChatGPT. I think that there are, I mean, I saw a graphic or a graph the other day just highlighting all of the different brands and businesses that are operating in the AI world. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of companies and tools that kind of live in the space. If you look at AI and I suppose the role that it plays and the benefit that it delivers and it's widespread, and you know, I think there's good reason for all the buzz around AI because the benefit is so immediate and so apparent. You know, you look at something like the metaverse. I don't know, there's all the rage about a year ago, 18 months ago. It seems to have died down a little bit because I think people are still trying to figure out what to do with it, what the application is, what the upside would be. It's like this interesting toy that I'm playing with, but I'm not quite sure where it's going to go. AI is quite different. I think the benefit's been pretty apparent and quite immediate. I think that what we see is a huge amount of automation of job functions that can happen through AI. Where a lot of slog work can be picked up, where, you know, you look at, I look at the legal business, for instance, a lot of admin work that happens in legal practices that you can see how AI can pick that up very, very quickly. Someone got AI to draw up a tenant contract for them the other day. It's a very, very good contract. I might tell you probably better than what most lawyers would be able to draft themselves. So I think it delivers a massive benefit in terms of automation. And what we see in the comms industry, for instance, is, you know, I can use AI to take one product feature and spin 5 different expressions of that instantly in terms of messaging statements that I can then go and auto-optimize and see which one of those work best in terms of what audiences connect with. So I think in terms of automation, I think there's massive benefit. I think in terms of assistance, I think it's very, very helpful. So, you know, you talk about getting AI to do your speech for you. I wouldn't necessarily get AI to do my speech for me, but I think if you had to do research, you know, what ordinarily would take you, could take you days to kind of wade through a whole lot of white papers and encyclopedias and Google this and Google that. You go onto AI and you go, you know, I need to know what the 5 key themes are to talk about today when someone asks me a question about AI, and it kind of pops it up. So it kind of gets you off to a good start. And I think a lot of that initial brainstorming that we see in the creative world, where it's kind of where you're just looking for something to hold on to, kind of, you know, AI gives you those little footholds on the mountain that you've got to climb quite quickly. So you can start to scale and you can elevate and you can get into the space of really being creative and innovative very, very quickly. So I think it's exciting. I think it's here to stay. I think that people have got to be open to understand it, use it to their benefit. I think as Scott Galloway said at Cannes recently, he said, everybody's afraid of AI and people are saying, is AI going to take my job? No, AI won't take your job, but somebody who understands AI is going to take your job. Mm. And I think that I thought that was a very, very good perspective on where AI is, but we are using it actively on a daily basis. If I look at the time that it's taken, for instance, historically for teams to do something like a storyboard for a TV ad, you know, frame by frame, or a reference board where you're standing in front of a client and you're saying, what I want to show you is, you know, we're going to open up on a lovely lady, you know, walking by the seaside in a red dress. But the only reference I could find is of a teenage girl in a short by a lake. So, you know, imagine it looks a bit more like the lady in the red dress by the beach. Well, now I can generate that in AI as an image.
In seconds.
So the accuracy of the reference, the speed with which you can generate it just becomes exponential. Can it go into the space where it can express emotion, where it can be creative? I'm not sure that we're there yet.
I think it can.
Maybe.
I mean, I remember putting ChatGPT through its paces. Once I arrived at a hotel and I saw a empty table with 2 chairs in front of a fireplace, and I put it into ChatGPT. And I said, there's an empty table with 2 chairs in front of a fireplace. And I wrote a couple of things, write me a story.
Yes.
And it printed out this deeply emotive story about unrequited love and what had happened. I looked at this. Obviously, it's, you know, grabbed that stuff from a whole lot of other areas.
Yes.
But when you read it cold, it's an emotive story. And the other day, a friend of mine...
I think it can mirror emotion.
But it might be able to... It might, but I think it still does evoke emotion in whoever is encountering it. Yes. So let me give you a live example. A friend of mine who's a senior executive at a large company just retired. And he's a very unemotional human being. And he sent me his farewell letter to the staff. And I wrote to him afterwards. I mean, I was quite choked up. It was an extremely beautiful letter. And I wrote to him and I said, that's the most beautiful farewell letter I think I've ever written. And he sent me back AR with a wink. So I think it can do emotion.
Perhaps, you know, I think the interesting thing is, I suppose that, you know, I think we still have a role in terms of how you edit. So how you assess quality, how you look at that emotion that's been generated and go, is that authentic?
Yeah.
Is it right? Is that me? Because I can get AI to generate it. It's a different thing on whether it reflects authentically on who I am as a person or the brand that you
would be using it for. And I just thought described layers I'd never discovered in our history.
Possibly. But I also think the other interesting thing is, you know, AI can only take from what exists.
Yeah.
So I think there is an opportunity, and I think with that there is a risk that AI leans into convention because of what it scrapes. And so I think the risk for me with AI is that you can end up generating a whole lot of ideas that are all kind of the same and that are all playing into the category. And you know, particularly when you start to look at the extent to which AI is applied in the world of kind of automated messaging and or automated automation or supporting the creative process, I think we've got to be careful that we don't end up in a world where, because we can generate mediocre thinking very, very quickly, that becomes acceptable. Because I think that what AI will do is it'll eradicate bad work, bad layouts, bad thinking, bad ideas quite quickly. It'll generate very average work frighteningly quickly. Can it do brilliant work? I don't know. I think it can support it. I think it can springboard it. But I think we still have a job to do there, because I think that, as I said, you know, you've still got to edit it. You've sort of still look at whether it's authentic. And I think most importantly, particularly as creative people and as innovators and as entrepreneurs, you've got a job to move into the open space, out of the contested, to not lean into convention.
Yeah.
And I think AI at the moment is still very much playing into convention.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I certainly think that if you had to say to me, has anything that I've encountered so far been unexpected? No, I wouldn't say it has. I think because of the nature of the tool, it's going to give you what you ask for in an expected fresh, when I say fresh, maybe executionally not idea-wise way. But
I also think there's an interesting challenge for people in our industry, Mike, and that's how you build your personal brand in the context of AI, because you look at art, for instance, you look at the art that's being generated by AI at the moment. But that art's not fetching the same price as an Andy Warhol is, or as a Irma Stern would, because Andy Warhol is Andy Warhol, is not AI. And I think it talks to the power of a brand. So I think that whether personal or whether in business, I think what AI is actually doing is it's actually pushing us into a space where we need to be more focused on how we build brands that are unique and that stand out and that have personality and have texture around it.
Yeah.
And because I think that's how you create differentiation versus falling into a trap where as a brand you start to look a bit like the category as a result of what AI does or can do for you.
And I think that is fun if you are wanting to play in a category, but if you are wanting to create open space, as you say, and create reappraisal and a fresh way of looking at something, it's going to be much more of a challenge.
Sometimes convention's fine. You know, as I always say, just call it business class. Well, what's British Airways calling it Club World? What does that mean? I don't know where I am. sometimes just calling it business class makes more sense. Convention's not always a bad idea.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I mean, I remember a tweet of yours, funny enough, in 2012. I think you probably left Twitter the following day. But I remember when you tweeted that, the basics, brilliant basics, like saying please, thank you, returning phone calls, paying on time, keeping promises, are all just great ways to differentiate businesses and doing the basics brilliantly. Jacques, you're a curious man. I know that about you. What are you most curious about at the moment?
Sure. I wasn't expecting that question. what I'm most curious about at the moment is to see what's going to happen with the next generation and how they're going to show up. And I'm talking about my kids, who are now kind of in their early teens, because I'm fascinated by millennials, and I can't even call them millennials anymore because I need to remind people that millennials are now in their 30s and they have kids and families. So probably like people in their kind of mid-20s. I suppose a lot of the young people that you see in the workforce today and how they behave, how they think. And I wonder I'm really curious to which extent my kids will be different. Because I think they will be different. But I definitely think that the 20-something-year-olds are very different, certainly to the way I am in terms of thinking, in terms of behavior, in terms of values, in terms of culture. Not being critical of them, I think there's lots that we can learn from the younger generation. But I also think they have flaws. Someone told me the other day that the current 20-something generation is the first generation that this planet has seen that has gone back backwards from an economic perspective, that is poorer than the previous generation for the first time ever. And I think that that's quite scary if you think about it. Maybe not a bad thing. Maybe they've got better work-life balance. But I'm curious to see what my kids are going to get up to, how they will change the world. You know, I think that it's There are a lot of challenges coming our way, coming their way. curious.
It's very interesting, obviously, you know, with me having my older son is turning 23, son of 20, another one of 15. And I see how so much of their interpersonal interaction today is via technology, via gaming, via WhatsApp messaging, multitasking at the same time versus just sitting down, you know, on the couch like we used to do back in the day and have a chat.
Yes.
You know, so I do think that, and I don't know if that's wrong per se. I think it's new. I think it's fresh. I think it's different. As long as we don't lose the human connection, I guess, in connecting with each other.
I think it's, you know, Mark, to that, when I look at my kids, there's, I suppose what does, not so much curious, but what worries me sometimes is that there's such a mindset around now and instant. And, you know, you talk about engaging on electronics, you know, the sense of I can sit back, press a button, and I'm entertained instantly. I don't have to put much effort into it. I can have everything now. I can go on to take a lot, order it, and gets delivered this afternoon. It's phenomenal. I love it. I love that world. But I do wonder to which extent the focus on the now, the short-termism, the instant, is going to come back to bite us, particularly in the world of brands and marketing, where everything is about what's the sale I'm generating today. What do the figures look like for this quarter? And actually, I'm only going to be in this job for the next 24 months because then I'm moving on to the next. So the whole measure of success becomes all about the now. And nobody's looking to the future and going, what am I building long-term as a brand? How am I building my career? You know, how am I investing behind relationships? And I think that's something that is going to prove a significant challenge on a personal and a business level, I think, for many of us as we move forward.
I agree with you. And I think that a lot of people don't think about when you measure the success of something in its lifetime. So, for example, if you had worked for Jeff Bezos at Amazon for the first 3 or 4 years, you would have left a failed business that was losing money. And if you had come back 10 or something years later, you would have met the richest man in the world, or certainly one of the top three. You know, if you at the same time you'd been in the mobile industry, you would have wanted to work for a BlackBerry or a Nokia, you know, and we are those brands today. So I think that there is a bit of a view on keeping an open mind in terms of how things change and how things evolve, and perhaps not judging anything in the moment as that being the finite point, but maybe being more curious, back to that word, about where those things can go.
The Street Store turns 10 this year. The world's first rent-free, premises-free, free pop-up store provides a dignified shopping experience to those in need, allowing them to choose from a selection of pre-loved clothing and shoes. Over 1,000 stores have been hosted around the world in the past decade, and now we're calling on you to host your own. Visit thestreetstore.org to sign up and find out how.
Shark, my late mom used to always say, contacts are contracts. And I just wanted to know from you, because, you know, you came into this advertising world, as I understand it, cold, without any contacts really in advertising, and yet you've had and continue to have a remarkable career. Which personal or professional connections do you think you've had that have helped you along with your career? And you don't need to name people per se, but maybe situations or examples, because I think there are probably a lot of people listening today that want to get ahead and say, but I don't know somebody important, whatever. But I don't know if when Pretty Yendi sang recently at the coronation of King Charles, if she knew anybody, you know, and there you've got this most famous, you know, South African opera singer singing there. Do you want to reflect a little bit on contacts, connections, and what do you think would be useful for people to know?
I think we all know people. You know, I mean, I just met 4 people this afternoon that I didn't know before. And I think that what people often do is they look at the person sitting next to them and they go, you know, are you going to unlock the next big opportunity for me? No, I don't think so, because you're not influential. You're not a captain of industry, but you are the person sitting next to me right now. And I have an opportunity to build a relationship, to create impact, to share a thought, to deliver value. Who knows who you know? And who knows who that person knows? Mm. And the kind of circle spreads from there. I always say you never know. I'm constantly surprised at how the world connects. You know, they say, you know, we're always like six or seven people removed from knowing, or having a friend.
6 degrees of separation.
That's the thing. Thank you. And so I suppose that's been my orientation, is not in terms of connections and building those relationships, not to sit and wait for the iconic person to come into the room and to go, you know, there's Sir Richard Branson, here's my opportunity, you know, but to just look at the people that you engage with and touch on a daily basis. Because I think if you shine there and if you showcase your values and your belief and through your behavior and what you do, you deliver quality and you deliver value, I think it creates ripples. I think that's how people reference you and how people talk about you. And, you know, you're sitting here and I don't know, you know, I know some of the people that you know, and, you know, and that's how I've connected, yeah. You know, not by starting off and saying, you know, how do I get to meet that CEO?
But keeping an open mind and joining the dots.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You never know where life is going to take you. And I suppose to be open to those opportunities, I always say, you know, you're sitting on a plane, who are you sitting next to? How many people take the time to strike up a conversation and go, where do you work? You know, what do you do for a living? Where are you from? You know, there's an opportunity to make a connection. I think one's going to be quite, Jane Fonda talks about friendships. How funny is that reference? Oh, as it came to mind. But she talks about friendships and she says, you know what? I decided I wanted to be friends with that person. She said, I believe that friendships are intentional. You have to work at it. It doesn't happen by accident or by chance.
Yeah.
And I think connections are intentional. And every day presents an opportunity to make a connection. But it's whether you decide to be intentional about it, to strike up that conversation. And I think a lot of it is, you know, how you build respect through what you do and you know, what you deliver. Was it like that's... You know, it's still word of mouth is still very powerful.
It is.
In building connections.
And credibility, I guess.
100%.
You know, can never underestimate the value of credibility and not being swayable, I think, on the important stuff, because surest way, I guess, to lose trust. I mean, I think the most enduring thing about any relationship is, or any new connection, is when other people can vouch for you.
100%.
Which I think is based on being solid, I guess, and
consistent.
Steadfast, not immovable, but steadfast in your views. Two more questions before I let you go. And talking about not being immovable and being steadfast, what important thing have you changed your mind about in your life?
Sure.
I'm not letting you get away.
I know. I always said to my wife that, you know, I want my kids to be clever because I can't imagine anything worse than having a child that's not clever. But I've changed my mind about that because I think it's far more important to be a good human being.
To be kind.
And to be kind. Mm. And I think if you can have that, you know, you'll have a full life and you'll have lots of people around you. And I think that, you know, age maybe brings this about, but I've changed my mind around things. I don't need as many things as I thought I did at one point in time. Mm. I was watching the Beckham documentary the other day and I laughed at how he got his weekly salary at Man U and he would spend the entire weekly salary that weekend and then be broke for 3 days until the next week's salary came in. I mean, they were quite big salaries. I think he bought an M3 with one salary. But they cut back to him and he says, you know, what can I say? I like nice things. And I do like nice things. I still like nice things, but I've realized that you don't need that. Experiences and people and relationships are far more fulfilling than things. But maybe that comes with age and the power of being able to choose.
I always say,
if you can say, yeah, I can buy it, but I choose not to, that's very liberating. If you can't buy it because you can't buy it, well, that's a bit depressing.
Yeah, that is true. You know, I remember once saying to my late dad, you know, Dad, money isn't everything. And he said to me, Yes, but you need to be rich enough in order to say that.
Exactly.
As you don't know where your next meal's coming from.
Exactly. As someone once said, I've been poor and unhappy and rich and unhappy, and I'd rather be rich and unhappy.
Jacques, talking about problems, that sounds like somebody's problem. What is the best problem you've ever had? As your last question before I send you on your way.
The best problem I've ever had. I think that the best problem I ever had was probably at the time when I had to make a decision as to whether I wanted to leave South Africa and leave Ogilvy, where I was the MD at the time, and go and work in another market. And I was exploring a number of different opportunities. There was an opportunity in the UK, there was an opportunity in Asia, and then in Australia. Mm. I mean, I always think those are nice problems to have because they present different opportunities, different challenges.
Yeah.
But I think that from a career perspective, Australia presented a significant challenge in many ways for me in terms of career, where I had to go into a market where I knew nobody. I didn't have the network that I had in South Africa. I didn't have the friends. And, you know, through those challenges, I grew a lot from a career perspective. So I look at a lot of those problems that I encountered in that market, and I think that I've learned a lot from it, and I've managed to come back to South Africa orientating very differently in terms of how I approach marketing and branding. So I think that that's been a really exciting problem for me to have faced and to have learned from. Call them problem or challenges. I actually think parenthood has been my other massive challenge, because my kids, sure, they test me. And I'm a bit of a control freak, so, you know, trying to, and I'm probably overprotective. So I have found that, and I'm a bit of a selfish person, I think, if I have to like lean into some of my weaknesses. And I think what kids do is they completely kick that out of you. It's not an available option. They also keep you humble, but they bring balance. And they, you know, they become proof that life is about more than, and not everything is as serious or as hectic or as bad as you might think it is. And they bring perspective. So I find parenting very challenging. I think that lots of people are natural born parents, as I call them. They just seem to do it with ease. I don't. I find it challenging every day, but I like it. You know, I think it's made me more kind. It's made me more balanced. It's made me maybe less hectic. And I think it's made me a better human being. So, it's a privilege to be a parent, challenging as it is.
That's a very, very important message to close on. And I guess there is no greater leveler in life than one's kids or as one's spouse. I've always said, you know, the world thought that Albert Einstein was a genius, and probably to his wife, he was the idiot that left his undies on the bedroom floor. So... Our kids keep us real. Jacques, it's been an absolute pleasure and privilege to have you in the studio today to chat.
Thank you, Mike.
I believe that problems aren't inherently a bad thing. By leaning into them, you can unlock a bright future. By running away from them, you won't accomplish anything at all. I've always said problems are like bullies. When you run away from them, they chase you. But when you turn on them, something quite different happens. Thanks so much for listening today. If you've enjoyed this podcast, well, why not leave us a 5-star review? Tune in to Willing and Able next time for more conversations that challenge perspectives.
This podcast is produced by Two Stories, written by Linda Scarborough, produced by Carol Williams, with audio editing, engineering, and sound design by Kozim Zimela, with production assistance from MNC Saatchi Group South Africa's team, Maciek Dubla and Nadia Siegel. Special thanks to Sonic Nursery and Edible Audio for the recording of these episodes.